gives a clarity of message that I, for one, really appreciate. In the last 24 hours, I've had the opportunity to kind of meet him face to face and get to know him a little bit on a personal level. I have to say that that's a heck of a ride. He's a lot of fun. But I mean, the main thing is that idea that he's a heck of a kickoff speaker for this festival. I'm hoping that in about an hour you're going to be saying, "Wow, what a great kickoff speaker for the festival." And with that, I want to call up Josiah B. from La Cañada, California.
All right.
I'm Josiah.
Hi, Josiah!
Thank you. What a great welcome. And you guys do an amazing job. Who here has been involved in organizing this thing? Put your hands up. Amazing. You guys are great. On my way up here, I took the liberty of looking at the Saskatoon Tourist Board website. And apparently, I'm the only one in this room that knows that you guys are supposed to be called the Paris of the Prairies.
You're making that up.
That's what it said, but I haven't seen nearly enough smoking. And the only abuse this American has taken is that your Coke machine at the airport wouldn't take my funny money. And I haven't seen a single Jerry Lewis movie advertised, so I don't think that's right. I'm glad to be here. Greetings from Los Angeles. La Cañada is a suburb of Los Angeles. It's the land of road rage. It's the land where your waiter is an actor, and the guy that works next door to you has a screenplay in development. I've got to tell you, with all that anger and all that ego, you qualify for Al-Anon just living there. You've changed the fifth tradition. The only requirement for membership is that you live within the city limits or that there be a problem of alcoholism in the family. But I do come from La Cañada in terms of my home group on Thursday night. It's a men's stag meeting at 7 o'clock. About 100 people strong every week, and it's where I get my recovery. And what I've learned there is that if I work a program of recovery, my life can get better. What I've learned there is that I greet the men that I know with a hug. What I've learned there is tell the men in my life that I love them. What I've learned there is how to work this program and make my life better. And what I'm going to talk about tonight is something that isn't talked about sometimes in Al-Anon. And I give the committee and Richard and all the rest of you a lot of credit for being willing to start your convention with this, because it can be a little difficult. And I feel very strongly about it, and I feel very privileged to be able to stand here and talk about it. What I'm going to talk about tonight is what's sometimes called the best-kept secret in Al-Anon. It's the 12 steps. And I'm a big believer in the 12 steps. And I get to work the 12 steps with my sponsor. I get to work the 12 steps with men that I sponsor. And I get an opportunity to watch people's lives change. The reading that we just read out of From Survival to Recovery is very true. It says that if we willingly surrender ourselves to the spiritual discipline of the 12 steps, our lives will be transformed. It's a very powerful statement, and it's powerful because of its truth. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story, about how I qualify for Al-Anon, what it was like, and what's happened. But I'm going to do it by walking through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into Al-Anon because of a daughter who was using drugs as a very young teenager. And I sort of stuck around because of the third tradition, which said the only requirement for membership. I wasn't particularly interested in your steps or your sponsorship, certainly not your service. I really wasn't interested in your God, but I was tired of living the way that I was living. And I didn't know what to do about my little baby. So I stuck around. And I've transformed from a third tradition member, the only requirement for membership, to a fifth tradition member. And I'm a big believer in the notion that we practice the 12 steps of AA ourselves. And I'll tell you that if you come to meetings and you have a little bit of fellowship and you listen to what people share, you're going to get something out of Al-Anon. You're going to get better. If you do service, you're going to get better. If you read the literature, things are going to seem different. But if you work the 12 steps as presented in AA, as interpreted in Al-Anon, you're going to see some magical things happen. And I can promise you that because it's happened to me, and it happens in the lives of the men that I work with over and over and over. I was sharing about the men that I sponsor in my home group a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of the men that I sponsor, obviously, are in my home group. And I said, you know, we were talking about the fifth tradition. I said, you know, I'm lucky. I get to sponsor a lot of men, dozens of them. And it's like I have this huge petri dish, this teeming petri dish. And the guys that I sponsor, looked at me like, what are you talking about? But it's true. I get this whole teeming mess of guys who come in, some version of broken, some version of in pain, some version of I don't know what to do, or even some version of I want to kill that. And things change. And I get the whole gamut. Anybody who sponsors more than a couple of guys knows what I'm talking about. You get the guys that come in and they're on fire and you can't slow them down. I've got a young man right now who said, I got a 130% in my last class in college. And I keep having to back him off of 130%. He won't wait. What should I do next? Wait. Then I get other guys who will call me occasionally and come to meetings, talk about doing the steps, maybe even do the first three. And then you hear the crickets chirping. And nothing happens. And I get everything in between, from guys who do absolutely nothing to guys who are on fire and do it, and then get guys to be sponsored by them and do it again. And here's what happens. There's a very close correlation between how much the men's lives change and how much of that work they do. So I am a big book thumping, 12-step work and sponsorship believing guy who says that if you're not doing that stuff, that's fine. That's part of the beauty about Al-Anon. It's not that other program where they say, if you don't, you'll drink, and if you drink, you'll die. None of that stuff going on here. You don't have to do that. But I'm here to tell you that if you want your life to get better, try this. Try this. It won't hurt. Well, maybe a little. So what I'll tell you is that when you come into Al-Anon behind a baby daughter, you have a hard time with the idea of the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I changed that child's diapers. I'll be damned if I'm powerless. I just haven't figured out how to quite corral it yet. I came into, in fact, my home group about 3 years before I finally came into Al-Anon to stick. And I was looking. How am I going to figure out how to tell her, how to work it, so that she'll stop this? She's 14. That's too young to be using drugs and drinking and behaving the way she is. I'll round her. Anyway, I actually joined a group, a parent support group, before I came to Al-Anon. And they said things like, don't round them because then you're grounding yourself. They said things like, if you don't trust what's going on in that bedroom, you can take the bedroom door off. They said things like, if she keeps misbehaving, you just keep taking her privileges away. I listened to those people, and eventually I had a daughter who had no telephone, no radio, no TV, nothing in her bedroom and no bedroom door on it. She would spend 6 hours a night locked in the bathroom. Pretty effective, right? And then I went to put the door back on the hinges and it never closed right again. Clearly not a program of recovery. Here's how powerlessness over alcohol manifested in my life with that child. She's over at some friend's house across town. I don't remember the specifics. I do know the police were involved. I do know I had been called over to pick up my child, and I do know I was in the white Dodge Caravan minivan. I remember driving home, and I was driving like an Al-Anon. And I was telling her, just like I told her 100 times before. And we got to a stop sign or a stoplight or whatever it was. And furthermore, and suddenly, poof, doors open, she's gone. Traffic, chase, completely powerless. My life was utterly unmanageable. I didn't know if I should drive or chase or what I should do. I don't remember what I did. I think I drove home. But the point is, talk about powerless. Talk about completely unmanageable. And that's where I was. I didn't know what to do with it. When I came into Al-Anon to stay, the worst of her issues, to my thought, were over. My fiancé insists that she was using at that time. I don't really know, and it doesn't much matter. All I can tell you is that a divorce had happened, and I was living in a place, and my daughter didn't have a place to live, so she ended up, and it was me and her, and I was acting like the complete jackass. I came back into Al-Anon to figure out what in the world had happened to my life and why I was behaving this way and why I was feeling this way. What I was told was, get a sponsor, take the steps. And I did. And the first thing I had to realize is that I had to acknowledge where I was powerless. I kept trying to do things different or do them more or do them louder or do them again and change things, and it doesn't work. At some point in our lives, we have to admit that we're powerless over certain things and that if something's going to change in the situation, it's going to have to change over here. When I work the first step with the men that I sponsor, what I tell them is that I want you to tell me what you're powerless over. Make me a list of the things you're powerless over. Most of the time it's her, them, whatever it is, work, the girl, wife, daughter, parents. And then how's your life unmanageable? I tell them that this is the one opportunity, the only time in working the 12 steps that you're going to actually talk exclusively about the problem. The first step is where we identify why it makes sense to spend a weekend doing what we're doing here instead of watching the game or water skiing or whatever in the heck else it is we'd rather be doing. Why this seems like a good idea. Why sitting in some crappy church basement on a folding chair makes sense on a Tuesday night. Because we're in that much pain. And the first step is where we identify what the problem is to the best of our ability. The good news is that once we've identified the problem, I've got 11 things that we're going to do next to make it better. Now, I came in here wanting nothing to do with God, wanting nothing to do with religion, really suspicious of the fact that you guys kept using the G word. So by the time I get to the second step, I'm already starting to get a little uncomfortable. Right? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, this is not what Bill Wilson meant when he wrote the step, but what I was told is, it's okay. Because all you really have to believe is that we, or Al-Anon, has a better idea. That made sense to me. I sat in that men's group of mine, and I listened to men talk about marriages that had been transformed, about relationships with children that had been transformed, about overcoming horrible, abusive relationships in the families that they grew up in, and I thought something must be working. I wasn't willing to call it God. I wasn't even really crazy about the fact that you capitalized the H and the P, but I was willing to admit that you guys somehow knew better. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. By the time I got there, I wasn't going to quibble over the use of the word sanity either. It just meant that my life really was unmanageable and I kept butting my head against the same wall over and over again. Now, Bill Wilson, of course, who wrote the steps, had a spiritual experience, a white light, oh my God, God is in the room spiritual experience. And he means when you take that second step that you're willing to believe that there is a God. I wasn't about ready to bite off all of that. But the point is, be willing to believe that there might be something, no matter how resistant you are to organized religion or any other concept of God or anything else, just start to believe that you don't get to figure it out all by yourself anymore. Third step says that I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. I heard that turn it over stuff and I had an idea. I knew exactly what it was. I pictured myself in a burlap robe with a rope tied around my waist and a tin cup in my hand. Turn it over. Right? I made a decision to turn my will and my life. You wanted my pocketbook. I'm here to tell you that the program of recovery that I work is requires neither a vow of chastity nor a vow of poverty. In fact, my life has never been bigger or better in every way because of these steps. In fact, when I think about the third step, I thought, okay, so if it's not a burlap robe, then what I do is I lay in bed and I say, okay, God, I'm making a decision to turn my will and my life over. Ready, go. Which reminds me of the rowboat story. The rowboat story I heard in an open AA meeting. The speaker said he had been in a meeting in Nashville, and this old alcoholic had said, here's how it works. Living your life is like rowing a rowboat across a lake. Now, you've rowed a rowboat before, right? You know how it works. You're not facing where you're going. You're rowing. Now, there's a tiller at the other end of that boat. God steers. You row, God steers. Now, you could get up and steer anytime you want, but if you ever expect to get where you're going, you better keep rowing. You can steer, but you better row, because guess what? God don't row. Where I get to on the other side of the lake is the surrender required of the third step. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. I get to row. He gets to decide where it goes. I've got to be willing to surrender results. I want my daughter, since I've started out with her as an example, to be a beautiful, happy, successful, wonderful young woman. What I get is something dramatically different. My job is to be the best dad I can be. Period. Defining that in a way that's healthy for both of us is what I do in the rest of the steps. And now guess what? Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Oh, man. Really? Why? She's the problem. I've got an inventory for you. She needs to go to school. She needs to stop doing drugs and those tattoos. You've got to be kidding me. And that boy, holy God, are you kidding me? I can take her inventory in a hot minute. But you're telling me I need to take a searching and fearless moral inventory of me? Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the details of why I qualify as an adult child in a minute. But what I'm here to tell you is that I walk around in a default setting that it's my fault. So when I hear you tell me that I need to take a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, I'm hearing you tell me that I got to pull all that stuff out that I've spent a lifetime covering up behind a really intricate facade. Now you want me to make a searching and fearless moral inventory? And I've heard those steps enough to know that what comes next is to tell someone. If I'm ever going to get better, and if I believe what I've decided in that first step about my powerlessness over the way you all act, then I dang well better start to change my piece of our relationship. And I can't change it if I don't know what it is. Can't change it if I don't know what it is. And the only way I'm ever going to figure it out is by doing these two next things. And you can't do one without the other. Make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I'm a control freak. I never, ever got the idea that my daughter's life was her business. Ever. I know exactly how her life should be. I've got really good ideas, and they're right. To this day, I call my sponsor up, and I on and on and on about her, the alleged girlfriend. On and on and on. He lets me just run out of steam, and then he says, okay, Josiah, you're right. Now what? It's the now what, okay? So at any rate, I'm a control freak. I believe that I'm not worthy of any of the good stuff in life. I believe I'm not worthy of your love because I'm a horrible person. I believe I'm not worthy of a good career because I'm a bad worker. I believe I'm not worthy of being a member of my own family because of the way that I treat them and allow myself to be treated. I have all these beliefs and all these behaviors that I engage in because of my beliefs. I get to those by doing a searching and fearless moral inventory. Now, there's a whole bunch of different ways of doing it. The best and my favorite is out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It involves columns. And by the way, as long as we've gotten to this point and we're just about to talk about one of the pieces where it's really important to have one of these, let's talk for just the briefest of moments about sponsorship. You can't do these steps without a sponsor. First of all, the fifth tradition says we practice the 12 steps. Some people say we work them. I will tell you that it involves paper and pencil or a computer at the very least. We write about them. We do them with someone who has done them, preferably who has also done them with someone else. Don't do them alone. Don't read them on the wall at your meeting and say, yep, they are the 12 steps, not the 12 ideas. So, I like the four-column method. The guy who made them up said that was the way to do them. I believe that. I believe the fifth tradition that says we practice the 12 steps of AA ourselves. By the way, I heard a speaker at a convention say, I was on the committee that first made the blueprint for progress. It was meant to be a 10th step. I said, good, because it sure states as a 4th step. Now, the 4-column method isn't the only one. To my way of thinking, it's the best one. I've done several other kinds. I like them. If my men are up to it, I ask them to do a 4-column, and I make them go through it 1 column at a time, meeting with me in between. They need guidance. What I need to get to is what I believe, what are my attitudes, what are my behaviors. I'll give you one. I don't like talking about it in front of crowds, but it's true, and it's really effective for telling you how this process works from 4 through 9. Here's the other thing about my character defects. I can't dress them up too much. I need to hear about them in really plain language. Earlier today, we were talking about how we like to call things incidents. It's so euphemistic. It's a train wreck, okay? So when I get to my character defects, I call them what they are. I'm unfaithful in my relationships. I'm not proud of it, but it's true. I'm an adulterer. Let's call it what it is. I'm also a liar. I'm also a coward. When I was in my home group meeting years ago, there was a tall, handsome, successful, charismatic man who carried the message with passion, and I thought, man, that guy is amazing. And the first time I heard him say in front of all of us, I'm a liar, a cheat, and a coward, I was shocked. I didn't know whether to be repulsed or to embrace him or what, but it rang so true to me. And what rang true to me was that, A, I'm that guy, and B, I want to be him. And to me, that little moment encapsulates what this program is all about. I can be that guy. I can stand here today and tell you I'm an adulterer. And then when we get down to it, I will tell you how I recovered from that behavior. I'm a different guy. But I have to identify that stuff first. Because here's the little trick that I play on myself. I believe at some part of me that I'm not a good enough man to be in this relationship. That the only reason I am is because I've done some great trick for her. I've done something nice for her. I've got a smokescreen up for her. I am not worthy of her love. I have that belief. It's a core belief. It goes back to the way I was raised. But as an adult, I go out and I perpetuate that belief by acting out because I don't know what to do with how I feel. I don't know how to confront her or communicate with her. I don't know how to fix what's broken in my relationship. And so I go out and it comes out sideways. I identify these things in my 4 step to the best of my ability. And then, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And then, I take that inventory and I go to a sponsor, preferably somebody I've been working with for a few months now, making phone calls to, and who's gotten to know me a little bit. And I sit down with him and we read it. And he does 2 things. He listens to the part that I got right, and just by listening and accepting, he takes some of the shame and power away from it. And then he tells me where I've got it wrong. This piece is almost as important as the first piece, because I do 2 things. One, I deny that I did anything wrong. I'm a victim. I only did it because she started it. It's not my fault. I deny it. I don't want to take responsibility for it. And then, on the absolute other side of the spectrum, I take responsibility for stuff that I had nothing to do with. You guys okay there? You comfortable? Hot enough? Cold enough? I'm responsible for 135 people right now. I have nothing to do with it. But I feel like it's my fault. I grew up in a family affected by alcoholism. Now, I didn't know that, but I did. And so somehow or other, when things were a mess, of course it was my fault. The parents are perfect, right? Couldn't be my brother and sister. They didn't do anything. It must be me. I sit down with someone who's not tied up with all the emotional energy of my history, and he can say, yes, Josiah, you're right. It's okay. We can make that better. No, Josiah, I think that was your fault. Or, wow, you had nothing to do with that one. Why do you think you had any responsibility? I sit with this man who has behaved exactly the way I've behaved, who has believed about himself exactly the same as I believe about myself, and he tells me it's okay. He tells me I can get better where I need to, and that it's okay, where it's just not my fault. The fifth step, where we sit down with someone else who's just like us and talk about how we feel and what we've done, is that magical little piece of why 12-step programs work. Think about it. Go back. Mother's Day, 1935. Bill Wilson comes staggering into Akron, Ohio, 6 months sober and on fire about some smoke screen scheme that he's going to get rich on one more time. The deal falls through. He doesn't get the proxies. He's going to drink. He walks into the Mayflower Hotel or something. There's a bar on one end and a church directory on another, and he makes phone call after phone call after phone call. Finally gets a hold of some preacher who tells him to call someone who puts him in touch with Dr. Bob. And a day later, Dr. Bob, who's hungover, pissed off, says, "I'll talk to him. I'll give him 15 minutes." And go to the guest house of the Cyberling Estate in Akron for 15 minutes. And 5 hours later, they walk out. And the seed is planted for Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's planted because one hope-to-die alcoholic who had just a minute of sobriety and said it can get better if we do these things, talked to another one who was completely hopeless and said, "Wait a minute, you drank like that? You did those things? That's what I do." And that's how AA was formed. And that's how sobriety works. There had been people, especially at that time in our nation's history, that were trying to get people sober left and right. Religious people, and medical people, and families, law enforcement, everybody was trying to figure out, how can we make these people sober? And when one hope-to-die alcoholic talked to another, something magic happened. And that's what we do here. I can come in here too proud to tell you that I don't know how to control a 14-year-old girl, and you can be okay. Because you say, "I know, me too. I have no idea. Not a clue." It's the fifth step. I sit in a room with 100 guys every week, and we have no idea. We're scared to death. One after one after another. Every guy, I feel like a frightened, trembling little boy in a man's body, and I don't know what to do. And it's okay, because there's 99 other guys who go, "I know." That's the magic of the fifth step. So now, the sixth step. We're talking about the six and seven steps today. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Now, I believed for a long time that some of the steps were filler. Because what Bill did was, he sat down to write this book. This was how AA was going to finally hit the map and make some money. And he wanted this to be his big selling point. The alcoholics had been going to Oxford group meetings. The Oxford group had six things that they did. They didn't call them steps, but there were six different things they had to do to make things better. And, you know, Bill wasn't just going to straight steal from them, unlike Al-Anon. We have no choice. We practice the steps of AA ourselves. We'll change one word just for the hell of it. Anyway, so there's six things they did, and I thought, okay, so he wanted it to be 12, and he just made some stuff up in the middle, hoping you wouldn't notice, right? The six and seven steps get about 4 lines in the big book. Not so quick. By the time Bill writes the AA 12 and 12 in 1951, 12 years later, whatever it is, he starts out the chapter on the sixth step by saying, "This is the step that separates the men from the boys." Because what it's really saying is that all of that stuff that I do, I've got to be willing to not do anymore. I've got to be willing to not only take off the Band-Aid, but pick off the scab. And let it be okay for you to judge me for who I am. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And even Bill in the 12 and 12 says that it is a goal that we aspire to. We will probably never reach it. I've got to try not to be that guy at all. To me, it implies an ongoing process. Done the steps once, have you? Good. Go again. Talk to your sponsor once about that behavior. Do it some more. Seventh step then says that I humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And Bill spends a lot of time in the AA 12 until talking about the meaning of humility. But to me, it's really important to understand that I'm asking for help. One more time, I'm asking for help. Women I go to meetings with first started her recovery in New York, and she brought something from her New York meetings that I really liked. She said, the sixth and seventh steps are just like the second and third, but with information. I like that a lot. It means that we've learned a lot about ourselves and our inventory. And now, just like when we do the second and third steps and get ready to do inventory, we do the sixth and seventh steps and get ready to do some amends. One of the things that I tell the men that I sponsor, sometimes to their great chagrin, is that if you look very closely at the sixth and seventh steps, what you're going to see is that nowhere in there, nowhere, is there any kind of a promise that anything is actually removed. I had one guy do an inventory, and he did some writing on the sixth and seventh steps. He came over to my house, and he said, okay, let's go. And I looked at him, and I said, okay, and I gave him my pitch. Nowhere in there does it say anything's actually removed, and his face just fell. He said, oh, really? I said, sorry, it's not a seven-step program. But at any rate, what it does do is it gets us ready to start on the next piece of it. As we were talking about earlier today, recovery is a process, not an event. So if you're thinking that the seventh step or anywhere else is a place where you go, wow, finally, I've gotten to this step and it's all going to be... No. No. It's an eroding process is what it is. And the sixth and seventh steps get us ready for what may be the most important part, to me, of what recovery is all about. The eighth step says that I make a list of all persons I've harmed and become entirely willing to make amends to them all. Now, if you do your inventory the way I like to have it done, you've got a list. It's the first column of your fourth step. If you don't, you can make a list. The way I do it when I do it is inevitably the same. I go like this: mom, dad, brother, sister, principal, teacher, wife one, wife two, daughter one, daughter two. I just go through everybody I can think of. And if I don't happen to have a resentment against them, if I don't owe them an amends, I take them out. Trust me, when I make that list, there's not a lot of names that get taken out. Make a list of all persons I've harmed, become ready to make amends to them all. Now, for a guy like me, that presents a certain problem, because I range between two extremes. We talked about the swinging of the pendulum and trying to find a place of balance earlier today. The place of balance for me is a place that I see swinging by as I go from one extreme to another. I know it's there. Back there somewhere. The notion of making amends is an interesting one. The ninth step, once I've made my list and I'm clear about who needs to have an amends made and why, I should have some idea of that from my inventory. Then the ninth step says that I make direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Now, I was really confused when I first came in, and I don't know if it's just because of the way my head works or if it's because of the way people interpret it. But here's my big deal about these steps, and if I pound the podium about anything, it might be this. Amends does not mean apologize. Oh, I made amends for that. No, you didn't. You apologized. It's different. Look it up. I have. Recently. Again. Amend to change or alter. You make an amendment to the Constitution. You Canadians understand that, right? Amendment to the Constitution. When it's not an apology, you're not paying somebody back. To change or to alter. I think part of my problem is that I've read the AA literature, and it sounds in that literature from 1935 as if you go around and say, wow, gee, I'm really sorry, but I was a hopeless drunk, and I owe you money, or I cheated on your wife, or I crashed your car, or whatever it is. And when I first heard that, it was an automatic for me. The cheapest phrase in this Al-Anon's vocabulary? I'm sorry. It's my default. I'm sorry. I'm taking responsibility for all kinds of stuff that's not my responsibility. Or I know it's really my fault. I have no intention of doing anything about it, but I know it's my fault. The phrase I'm sorry just comes to my lips like that. The amends process, however, is only incidentally about apologizing. I need to identify by making a list of people that I owe amends to, where in my life my behavior and my attitudes need to change. Now, Al-Anon is by definition a program of relationships. Theoretically, you don't qualify for this program if you don't have some kind of a relationship with an alcoholic. So the fact that our pivotal moment in recovery comes in changing the way we relate to people makes perfect sense to me. What I need to do when I make an amends is, I'm sorry for the way that I behaved with you. It was wrong. I will try never to do that again. I need to change my behavior. So, an easy one. I go to my daughter, my glorious addict daughter, and I say, sweetheart, what I know about myself is that I seem to sway with your wind. I seem to feel every feeling you have. I don't give you the dignity of living your own life. I don't wait for the question mark. I first heard that in an Al-Anon meeting and I fell down. Wait for the question mark. Kidding me. My daughter and I do this dance. She'll say, I really want to go to the movies. I don't have any money. How much do you need, honey? I really want to go to Jane's house. By the way, my daughter is 27 years old and does not have a driver's license. This is how good she is at this. I want to go to Jane's house. I don't have any way to get there. You want to ride? One of my amends to my daughter is I told her, you're going to have to ask when you want something. Now, I watched her face fall because she knew if that was true, the jig was up. But now I've given her the dignity of being able to actually ask for what she needs. And like I said, she's 27-year-old, still doesn't have a driver's license, so somehow she's managing. Didn't take me. Here's one of the things that happened early in my Al-Anon recovery that just blew my mind. She called me up. Daddy, oh my God, Daddy, we broke up. Oh. Honey, are you okay?
Yes.
Baby, is there anything I can do?
Well.
Would you bring me some cigarettes? Sure, honey. So one thing led to another. It's 2 or 3 hours later, I completely forget the cigarettes. Thank God. And it was only a lapse of memory or a higher power doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I drive up. She and the boy, hand in hand, walking out the front of the building. Such a sap. Here's a harder one. Like I said, I've never been faithful in a relationship. So, making direct amends wherever possible. By now, I'm divorced from these women. I'm sorry, sweetheart, I was unfaithful on important points. No, except when to do so would injure them or others. And this brings me to the most important part. I make amends for that behavior now by being faithful in the relationship I'm in today with the alleged girlfriend. Whole long story, ask me about it later. I'm faithful to that girl. And here's why. And this is why the amends process is so important. Why it's so important for us to know that it's about changing our behavior and not just apologizing and try to make things nice between us. I've told you that my character defects all stem from my belief that I'm a horrible person, not worthy of my membership in the human race. And then I go out and act consistent with that belief over and over again. If I'm faithful today, if I honor the commitment that I've made so that I feel better about myself, then I can slowly start to erode that faulty belief about myself. We talked about it this morning a little bit. If I act like an honorable man of dignity and courage in every part of my life today, particularly in that relationship, at work, with my kids, even on the freeways in L.A., slowly, my world starts to shift. I get treated like a man. Who is that guy? When all of the evidence coming at you from your outside world tells you that you're an okay guy, it gets harder and harder to believe that you're a piece of scum. I act like an honorable man in my relationship today, the most important impact it has is on me. Now that crazy girl likes the fact that that's the guy I am today, but it's not about her. It's about me. Here's another one. My inventory, I was sure that my inventory was going to include lazy. And it didn't. I'm not lazy. I'm just really selective about where I put my effort out. What I found out was the reason I had the work history I did wasn't because I was lazy. It was because I was scared. I was afraid if I tried in that job and I failed, I would be screwed. But if I didn't try very hard and I failed, then it was because I not tried hard, not because I was unable. It made sense to me. So my amends is to go into work every day, to show up, to do the job they pay for, cheerfully. Give them an honest day's work, and then maybe a little bit more, with a good attitude. If you see me in the halls of my office, ask me how I am today. You're going to hear me tell you, it's just another day in paradise. Every time. I did it back 2 years ago when I was in a job that I hated, where they wouldn't promote me and where they were overworking me and asking me to do things that I didn't know how to do. Scared to death and angry. And every day, the jacket was buttoned, the tie was up, and it was just another day in paradise. Now, I went to one of my former employers that I treated really badly and tried to make amends to him. He looked like a Labrador Retriever. Oh, no idea. Sometimes going back and making amends to them is meaningless. And if we go back thinking that it's got something to do sometimes with making them tell us it's okay, we're hosed, the way you would put it. It's not the point. The point is, that's the pivot point. That's the place where I get to change who I am. So the amends process, crucial. We talked earlier about fake it till you make it. That's what we're talking about here. You may not believe that you're the best employee in the place, but act like it. You may not believe like that wonderful woman is, that you're worthy of her. Act like it. Act like it. Things change. So then, the 10th step. Continue to take personal inventory. When we were wrong, promptly admitted. That's Bill Wilson code. 4. Do 4 through 9 over and over again. Do it in little daily ways. Do it in big ways. Do a whole 4-column inventory every once in a while. I was telling the guys earlier, I heard one word in a meeting 2 years ago. One word. I heard a guy talk about being impatient. And I went, oh, that's never been on an inventory. And that's probably top 5 of my defects of character. I did a whole new inventory to make sure I got to that. Crucial, I'll tell you about it in a second. So the 10th step says, we do that stuff over and over again. I have these wonderful, hard-working, big-hearted Al-Anon guys call me up and tell me they're scared to death. And I say, I want you to do a 10th step. I want you to do a 10th step every day of the good stuff that you did. You got up. You fed yourself, you went to work, you showed up on time, you put in an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, you came home, you didn't kick the dog, you didn't use the finger on anybody on the freeway. Everywhere that you can say something good about yourself. It's really crucial in our 10th step that we acknowledge our character assets as well. Those of us that grew up in families affected by alcoholism come away from them believing we're terrible people. And most of us, paradoxically enough, are really wonderful. This program helps us to understand that. You guys going to let me cheat by a few minutes since you started in that? All right, good. There's some good stuff coming. The 11th step says, Satsang, prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, the good news for me, and for you if you're at all like me and you're still on the other side of it, is that by being around, sticking around and doing this stuff, I've come to believe that there's something, a power. Now, I think that, frankly, there are a few places where I think Bill got it wrong, and it's really a shame he never got a chance to ask me because I could have helped. But he wanted to have the God stuff in there because he'd had this white light experience, and even back in 1935, some of the original members said, we don't believe in God, and we're sober because we do everything else in this program. You can't be pounding the table about God. So that's why we got, as we understood him, thrown in there as a way of softening that blow. But there's a woman who goes to meetings that I go to, and she's been in recovery forever, and she says, you know, it's not so much the God of my understanding as it is the God of my experience. And I've heard people say that if God was small enough for me to understand him, he wouldn't be big enough to do what he does. So I don't try to understand anymore. I just try to believe. I try to trust. I stay stuck in that second step thing all the time. Came to believe. Do I really believe? Am I willing to trust that it's going to be okay? So by the time I get to the 11th step, I've had some kind of a subtle transformation. Again, a process, not an event. And I'm willing to say that, yes, I will ask for guidance, especially the way the program teaches me to. Not to ask for stuff, not to ask for events. When I pray for my kids or my family or for you, I say, God, I surrender them to your loving care. It's none of my business. And if I have enough faith in you, and in God, and in myself, it can be okay. The notion of meditation now is an interesting one for me. I don't really hold still, and this thing never shuts up. So the notion of getting quiet enough to try to find some peace and to try to find some kind of a connection with a very, very, very subtle and mysterious force in my life has been really difficult for me. And I've gone to an outside source to try to get training in that. I try really, really hard on a daily basis to take a minute. And for me, I haven't levitated, not yet. I occasionally get something that I consider to be a message. More than anything else, the notion that I can sit quietly with just me is really profound. It's an ongoing process. And the more comfortable I get with just me, the more okay it is for me to sit quietly. And now the challenge is for me just to find the time and the peace between my ears to be able to do it. I want to spend just a minute talking about the 12th step. The 12th step I could have talked the whole time on. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I did not come in here for that. I wanted to figure out how to fix my daughter. I did not sign up for a spiritual awakening. Now, part of the reason I didn't is because I didn't understand what that meant. A spiritual awakening for me can be as simple as I'm not as bad as I think I am, and life doesn't be as has to be a, as hard as I make it. It doesn't have to be anything more than that. It doesn't have to be some metaphysical hocus pocus. It just has to be, I'm not as bad a guy as I think I am, and it doesn't have to be as hard as I make it. Spiritual experience can be a whole bunch of other stuff, but it can be as simple as that. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others. And you know, I have a lot of fun doing this. I really do enjoy standing up here and being a goof and telling you how strongly I feel about this. But as much as anything, the phone calls I get from sponsees, or just the hugs I get when I walk in, or just knowing that if I miss a meeting for a month or a year, I can show up, reading the literature and seeing something that's just profound and moving. There's so many different ways that the message gets carried. And to me, knowing that there are other like-minded people, other people who feel the way that I do, is such a comfort, because so much of what gives my character defects power is the shame and the guilt that I feel. I can't possibly confess this to you, that I was that guy, that I feel this way about myself. So the message gets carried, just sit here. Okay, make animal sounds occasionally, but just sit here. God bless you guys for that. I was looking at the room before we started, I thought, oh my God. I need help here. Come on, you guys need some energy. And then you were braying, and I thought, it's all good. We're fine. The biggest part to me about the 12th step is we practice these principles in all our affairs. And I've already talked a little bit about it when I said that the amend steps is where I start to act differently and allow my world to reflect back to me a new man. Now, the 12th step, practicing these principles in all my affairs, allows me sometimes to figure out when I should say no, sometimes when I should say yes. It's helped me to understand I practice these principles in all our affairs. How I behave in meetings is how I behave in the outside world. Here's some examples. How to say no. I told you how I behaved with that daughter of mine. She called me up a little over a year ago and said, Daddy, I need your help. I'm addicted to painkillers. And honest to God, I mean, Vicodin, OxyContin, I mean, gobbling them like sweet tarts. And we got her on a train, and she was a wreck. I mean, they had her strapped to a bed, and they were detoxing her. The poor little nurses in that place, they didn't know what hit her. Hurricane Julie's in town. So she detoxes. She's trying to find, she's been kicked out of her house. She's lost her job. She's lost her cell phone. She's got nothing. And she's just about to get out. And she says, "Daddy, Daddy." Yes. Oh, Kelsey, her sister. "Kelsey and I found a great apartment. We're going to live together." "That's good, honey. We need deposit money. Will you loan us deposit money?" "Oh, no, it wasn't deposit. It was better. We need you to co-sign for the apartment." "Sweetheart, you have no job. You're about a minute and a half sober. And I'm paying for the last loan I co-signed when you got your wisdom teeth out." "I'm sorry, sweetheart, I can't do it." "I told her no. I practice these principles in all my affairs. I get a little more clear on when it's okay for me to say yes and when it's okay for me to say no. And my no, or my yes, is no longer motivated as much, as often, by my concern about whether that child will still love me." Now, happy ending, she got the apartment anyway. And I paid the last months from the last place she wrecked when she was still high, paid off the wisdom teeth, and now I have a nice relationship with her. Sometimes I give them money. We don't even pretend to call it a loan anymore. So I learned how to say no. Sometimes I learn how to say yes. My parents came into town a couple of months ago, over the summer. And they've moved to New York. Cold weather, can you imagine? From California. My brother lives out there. And my brother has two sons. My sister still lives in California. And she has two sons. And so, you know, my crazy dad has gotten to the point where he thinks that, you know, when the family moves around, it'd be nice to get everybody together. And I've worked out the resentment I have for the fact that you didn't do this with my kids for a little. Honest, I have. So, it's my parents coming out, my 80-something-year-old parents, with the two boys, and my sister's kids and my brother's kids are going to be together, and so I was really clear about how much time I could spend with all that. I really wanted to see my parents. They're getting older. I really didn't want to be around four chaotic boys very much. So, they're going to go to Disneyland. You know, the boys live in BFE, Mid-State New York. You know, for them, fun is going to Buffalo for a hockey tournament. And so they're going to go to Disneyland. And I said, you know, I'm not going to Disneyland. I'm not going to take a day off work and run around in 90-degree weather with 8 billion other people trying to keep track of four crazy boys. I said, no. So I got together with my parents that weekend. We all got together. It was nice. And so they were talking about Disneyland. And my dad said, yeah, well, so, okay, I'm going to Disneyland. I said, Dad, why are you going? He said, well, you know, and he didn't, because of the amazing, uncanny ability my family has of communicating directly, he didn't really say, but it was clear that my sister didn't feel she could handle all of them, and there needed to be another adult, and eeny, meeny, miny, mo, my little Al-Anon dad was the guy left. And I said, Dad, why don't you let me do it instead? No, son, that's okay, I'll go. I said, no, really, Dad, you just let me know. I said, why don't you think about it and let me know? I said, well, maybe. Okay. And I went to Disneyland. And it was hot, and it was crowded, and it was annoying, but I went because it was the right thing to do. When I told my dad I would go, the relief on his face was palpable. It was the right thing to do. So sometimes I say no because it's the right thing for me and probably for her. Sometimes I say yes because it's the right thing to do, even though I don't want to do it. Practicing these principles in all my affairs results in this, that I'm not going to be able to get through it without crying, so just bear with me. The way alcoholism manifested in my family was through my father. The sweetest man you can imagine. And as untreated Al-Anon as anybody I've ever known. His father was a raging alcoholic. I never, ever even saw the man. And my dad would not talk about it. My father denied the existence of a whole second family that his father had. His father remarried and had a bunch of kids. My dad's got half-siblings all over the place. My dad pretended like it never happened. He isolated us and protected us as much as he could because he thought it was the right thing to do. And here I am with all of the manifestations of alcoholism and confused as hell about it. Those of you that grew up with crazy alcoholic rants and bottles rolling down the stairs, consider yourselves lucky. You know why you're screwed up. I had no idea. I just knew I never did it right enough or good enough or smart enough or fast enough. My dad would be working on the car, he'd say, give me that quarter-inch box wrench, and I'd hand him a crescent wrench, and he'd go, God damn it! I had no idea. He was an untreated Al-Anon, scared to death. When I did that inventory on impatience, one of the things that I knew for sure and for certain was that it manifested itself when I spoke with my beautiful old man father. I'd call him up and say, Dad, what's going on? He said, son, I've just read the most interesting history of China. And I thought, oh my God, 5,000 years of history is going to want to talk about it right now. Well, Dad, that's great. You know, I should probably run. I was ashamed of myself. I thought, you know what? You live 3,000 miles away from that man. You don't have to talk to him ever. But when you choose to talk to him, you make sure you're completely invested in that and that you be the best son you can be. And if he wants to talk about the history of China, well, then you call him and you've got time. So you know what I did? And I would say, Dad, what's going on? And he would launch. Not only would I listen patiently, but I would listen actively. I paid attention and I responded. First time I did that, about 5 minutes into the conversation, he ran out of gas and said, well, son, I should probably let you go. You're kidding me, right? Why didn't somebody tell me this years ago? And you know what? It happened over and over again. If I had not done that inventory, if I had not worked the steps, if I had not heard that word, if I had not been part of this program, I would not have had that recovery. My father died on August 26th. Really suddenly. The beauty is, he was with my mother on a barge they had rented, sailing down the Erie Canal. They docked, they went to bed, he woke up the next day, he felt badly. By lunchtime, gone. No suffering, nothing. He was doing what he loved the most, he was saved. Now, I'm racking my brain in the days and weeks that follow, trying to remember the last time I saw him, the very last time I saw him. I don't remember it. And I'm trying to remember the last time I spoke to him on the phone, I don't remember. I just don't remember because I didn't know it was going to be the last time. There were no goodbyes. There was no drama. But here's what I know. Because of what you taught me. No matter what, the last time I saw him, I hugged him. No matter what, the last time I spoke with him, I told him I loved him. It's because of the man you made me here. I love this stuff. The 12 steps work, you guys. Work them. Thank you.